Illegally Deaf is a podcast about overcoming obstacles. I'm Danny Burnside, and just this year, I was diagnosed with severe hearing loss. Oh, did I mention I'm a professional Hollywood voice actor? Funny how that goes. I've made the decision to own my disability and interview remarkable guests who are thriving in light of being disabled. Welcome to the Illegally Deaf Podcast.
Hey, Eileen, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time tonight. So, Eileen, you're from Alaska originally.
It's beautiful. My sister and I went back on a little summer trip about 10 years ago, and it was just unbelievable.
It's been a dream of mine to either get up there on a cruise, or if I'm risky enough, to take the 5 all the way up, hit Seattle, hit Vancouver, and cross over. That's actually how I'd like to do it, road trip style.
My dad used to do that road trip from Fort Lauderdale.
Oh my goodness.
To Alaska.
I was actually just in Fort Lauderdale earlier this year. Do you have family out there? Your dad lives out there?
Well, we grew up there. No, my parents passed away. My dad passed away a long time ago.
I see.
But after my mom died, he started going on these road trips. And when we were young, they used to do that from Alaska, like a camper, the Alaskan Highway.
Really cool. So, folks, my guest tonight is an actress, a writer, a producer, a lifetime member of the Actors Studio. She serves on the Peer Group Executive Committee for the Television Academy. She also serves on the SAG-AFTRA National Performers with Disabilities Committee. She's won over 50 international awards for her disability-inclusive short films. Her credits include This Is Us, Hung, CSI Vegas, New Amsterdam, SWAT, Watchmen, Sons of Anarchy, and much, much more. And here's the cherry on top. She's a post-spinal cord injury walker who was paralyzed from the waist down as a child. The doctors told her parents she would never walk again. I met her 2 weeks ago, and guys, she was walking. The one and only Eileen Gruba. Welcome to the show, Eileen.
Thank you. What an intro.
And there's a lot more to that intro. I left off a lot of credits, but I'm going to link your IMDb in the show notes. Our audience can have a look.
Oh, thank you.
So real quick, guys, Eileen and I met 2 weeks ago at a super, super cool panel put on by the Television Academy in LA. It was called The Power of TV, Ensuring Authentic Disability Inclusion. Now, I was in the audience, but Eileen was a panelist. And let me just tell you, when Eileen speaks, people listen. And that is the truth. Her passion is palpable. So I approached her afterwards and just shook her hand because I so appreciated your passion, Eileen. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Actually, we had that event because of 2 years of hard work with me and the executive committee. And Kim Estes was the first one to come up with the idea. And then Kelsey, who was there, Kelsey Scott, and I built that event for nearly 2 years to get it launched at the TV Academy. So more than just a panelist, we created the initial intention of the whole thing and tried to build it to be something that would be a game changer for our industry rather than the same old, same old.
I learned a lot. I learned that although about 20% of folks have a disability in the U.S., film and TV only showcases about 3.1% of characters having disabilities. That's wild.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And of those characters, up until just the last couple of years, about 95% of them were played by people without disabilities.
Right. Wow.
So then do the math and figure out how many people who are performers with real disabilities actually ever get the chance to work.
Okay, so let's rewind. I want to go back to your childhood, not even talking about disability at this point. Did you always love the arts? How did you fall into being an actress in the first place?
I did always love the arts. I mean, my brothers used to make fun of me when I was a little girl because I collected every pretty thing I ever saw, whether it was a magazine or a little cutouts. I used to do paper doll cutouts, and I would carry every little crafty thing I could find around in little bags everywhere I went. So I'd always be able to have something to play with and create with. So I was always creating. I was always an artist. And then when I did end up paralyzed, I was sort of stuck in my room when everyone else got to go out and play in the snow. And I was figuring out life as it was unfolding. And I ended up doing a whole lot of artwork as a little girl, from building Barbie doll houses to spaceships the size of my room out of every cardboard box I could get my hands on. So I've always been an artist.
Were you singing at a young age as well? I know you've done some Broadway musicals as well. Were you also singing at a young age?
I was always singing because church. We went to church and we sang in church. And then when I got older, I started in the church choir. And there we had some of the greatest vocal coaches. So I learned to expand my range. And then when I went to New York City in my 20s, I studied with the best of them. the very best. And that's when the musicals really picked up. But we used to do musicals at church when I was young, when I was in my early 20s.
I was a vocalist as well in my youth, and I was heavy into choir and vocal jazz. And I have the exact same backstory, Eileen. I learned to harmonize listening to church choirs, just in church in the audience. I didn't participate in the choir till I was a teenager. That's where I learned to harmonize, looking back on it.
Wow. And your voice is fantastic, by the way.
Thanks. My dad was a musician and a singer. He passed away as well, but he was a lead guitar player for, you know, like rock and roll style, classic rock, and also a vocalist. I guess my grandma as well. So I think I owe it to my grandma's side of the family. But I think the first album I ever bought was the Beach Boys' Greatest Hits because I just loved harmony so much.
The Beach Boys, they're the best. We grew up on the Beach Boys.
Right on.
And even went to see them when we were in college at University of Florida. They came and played.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah.
So how did you fall into studying with the Actors Studio?
Oh, wow. Okay, when I first moved to New York City, it was a dream of mine to get into the Actors Studio because I had watched so many movies and I used to listen to the inside the Actors Studio and tape the episodes and learn. And so I always wanted to be in the Actors Studio. And when I was in New York, I used to walk down 44th and watch the people come out and be like, I want to be a member of the studio one day. And I remember a girl telling me, a Juilliard grad, I remember her telling me, well, you'll never get into the Actors Studio. And I was like, what? And I was young. I was in my 20s. And she was like, no, I know so many Juilliard grads who've auditioned over and over and over, and it's just so hard to get in. And I just remember saying, well, that's not going to happen to me.
Love that.
So I did get in, and thankfully, out of probably ignorance and courage at the same time, because I was asked to do a piece with a girl and it just happened to be perfect for me to put my life experience into. And so I did this piece where I'm playing a girl who was paralyzed from being hit by a taxi. She's angry and she's taking it out on her maid and nurse. And I thought, yeah, I'd be pretty angry if you paralyzed me again. So let's let it rip. And so I worked on it for a while. And that was my first audition for the Actors Studio. And it got me all the way to finals. And no one even knew me, but I knew how to put my life into my work.
Perfect transition to your injury. Let's go back to you almost turning 5 years old, a couple months before your 5-year birthday. Walk us through what happened that led to you being paralyzed.
Oh, vaccines for school. All of us were marched into this office to get all the vaccines for school. And we had DPT and oral polio in the same day. I remember well that the one in my arm kept bleeding because I said to my mom, mine keeps bleeding, it keeps bleeding. And over the next few weeks, I just started having little neurological issues, like little weakness and things like that, tingling and weird things. And about 30 days later, which is the norm with Guillain-Barré syndrome, I dropped. I was playing with my siblings in the park and running and I doing flips and goofing off and doing fine. And then all of a sudden I did a little flip and I couldn't get up. I couldn't feel my legs. Yeah. And it was just that it struck at that moment, and I ended up having to drag myself across the park on my arms and telling my mom my legs won't work. And, you know, I'm 5 and she's like, you're fine. A mom of a bunch of kids. She's right. Like, I don't see any blood. You're fine. And she set me on a picnic table and put a blanket over me. And by the end of the day, when they brought me home, I couldn't even walk. They put me on the toilet because she could see my bladder was distending and I fell off. And they put me in a warm bath and I slid down in the water. That's when they rushed me to an emergency room and the journey began.
Do you remember these events pretty vividly?
I remember a lot of it. I have very vivid memories of the shot that was bleeding. I have memories very much so of running down that hill and playing, running with my sister. And when I fell and couldn't get up, I remember sitting on the bench. I remember falling off the toilet. I remember sliding down in the bathtub because I was like, I thought I was going to drown. And I remember the horror of being brought to the hospital and them taking me out of my mom's arms. And I was like, don't leave me. I still get emotional when I retell that because I still remember saying, don't leave me here, don't leave me here. I literally, as a child, thought they were trying to kill me. I thought they were trying to kill me.
Wow.
Yeah, because you're little, you don't understand these things, you know. And I also remember at one point when they didn't know how to help. They were trying to save my life, and then they had to put me in an ambulance and take me to a bigger city because we were in Arkansas at the time in a little town called Rogers. and they ended up having to ship me to a bigger city. I remember being strapped into a gurney and getting put into an ambulance and my mom climbing in and she was looking down on me. And here's this little child looks up at her and says, "Why are your eyes watering?" I just didn't know, you know, and it took a lot of years of life to understand what my mother went through.
We talk about sense memory and acting. Well, you have a plethora of sense memory to pull from, don't you, Eileen?
I do.
So from that point on, you were in a wheelchair for a couple years?
I was. They told them that I would never walk again. At first, they said she won't live.
Oh, my goodness.
And I did. They had me in the literal nurse's station. And I remember that well because I was like, why am I in here? And they told me it was because I was special and they liked me. And I believed them. They gave me my own nurse's hat. But I remember just the things they stuck in my spine and the little things they stuck all in my chest that made blisters. And I just remember all those things, you know, the IVs. I still have trauma about IVs when I have to go under, which is every year. So there's a lot there. And I remember it all. And I was in the wheelchair for a couple of years and it was a slow progression. And it was because I couldn't wrap my head around why I couldn't walk anymore. I was just too young to understand it. And so I just kept trying and trying and trying. And I used to slide myself off my bed, like my chest down on the bed. And I would slide myself with my arms till my feet were on the ground and then kept trying to stand. And I would fall a lot and my mom would come running. And I just kept doing it over and over and over until I got to the point where I could finally just stand holding onto the bed. And then it was like a toddler learning how to walk again. You know how they'll hold on to something and then slide one leg sideways. So my right side picked up faster and it's still stronger. Left side kind of dragged behind. I had a walker for a while and I probably would have done a lot better if they had physical therapy like they do now.
Yeah.
But we didn't have that when I was a kid. It was just all figuring it out on our own. So by the time I was in high school, I started having to have surgeries to rebuild all the little parts that were damaged because I was up and jumping and running around on them when there was a lot of nerve damage and muscle atrophy. And I've had surgeries all the way up until 2017.
Wow.
I think 2018 was my last surgery, but 2017 was the last one on my legs. I don't want any more.
You willed yourself to walk.
I completely willed myself to walk. Yeah. And for a lot of years, doctors were like, we don't even understand this.
Wow.
Even the doctors back then told my mother it was the closest thing to a miracle that they had ever seen.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah. And I still keep willing myself to walk because you never really fully 100% recover from these things because all of the stuff that, the residual damage, you know?
Sure. So you're a senior in high school. You're considering moving to New York City to pursue acting and you have this disability. Did your parents try to talk you out of that at all or were they encouraging?
I wanted to go to New York to go to the Fashion Institute of Technology. I wanted to be a fashion designer. And I had gotten a partial scholarship, art scholarship to college. And I ended up going to University of Florida, getting my undergrad. I lasted there a few years and then I was like, I want to go to New York. I want to go to FIT. And it was one of the only times that my mom really threw fit. She threw fits. She was very worried. And I remember the words she said. She's like, she was terrified that if I went there, I'd get attacked or I'd get killed or something because she knew somebody that happened to their daughter. So she just really was upset about it. And she said to me, don't you understand? You look like a victim. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I had no clue what she was talking about. And she said, because if somebody's going to jump on somebody, it's going to be you because they're going to see you walking and they're going to know you can't get away. And really bothered her. So I ended up not going there. I ended up going to Atlanta. Long story short, I started doing art things there, but I got drawn into the acting world in Atlanta. First, somebody asked me about modeling gowns, wedding gowns and stuff. And I was like, why not, you know? And I was going to do interior design for houses, and I was starting to work on that. And then the modeling thing, I just, the first experience was a little weird. And, you know, what would get you canceled these days if you were a photographer? It was weird, and I felt weird, and I got the hell out of there. And then I thought, if I'm going to do anything in this business, I'm going to learn about it. So I started going to school. So I started going to Alliance Theater School in another private class with a teacher, a female teacher. And I started just learning the craft. And that's when I really fell in love with it. And it was right at the time that I was doing musicals. And incidentally, right at the time that I had to have the first major rebuild on my left foot and ankle. So I was doing musicals while I could hardly walk. But in Atlanta, they didn't care. They were so helpful and accommodating. I'd be the girl in a slinky dress on the piano singing, laying on the piano. I played Cinderella in construction boots.
Love it.
And high top tennis shoes under the gown when it came to the gown. And when I was playing one of the silly girls in Beauty and the Beast, they had this huge guy that was playing Gaston. And I wore a dress to the floor with construction boots. And I slinked up the aisle the best I could. And when I got to the front, I couldn't walk up the stairs. So they had him reach down and grab me by the waist and spin me around and set me on top of the stage.
Yeah.
And that's how we did it. They were so creative. So that's how I started doing all the musicals and stuff in Atlanta.
What vocal part are you? Are you a soprano?
I was an alto, and then I did some more training and learned I was a soprano, yes.
Mm, okay, cool. I used to be a tenor. I'm definitely a baritone now.
I can hear that.
I've lost a lot of my higher register. Just over the years, it's how it goes. I've almost completely lost my falsetto from my choir days in high school.
Oh, wow.
I guess I've gained some on the lower end of my range, but I definitely lost the falsetto.
I don't train like I used to. When I trained, I could hit notes I didn't even think were possible. And a lot of times in New York City, when I was training with like Phyllis Grandy and George Axeltree, who trained the Broadway singers, they'd give me a piece of music and I'm like, ah, and I'm like, I don't think I can hit these notes. And Phyllis would always be like, yes, you can. And she would make me show me how. And so that's how I got to train my voice. And I auditioned for musicals in New York City, and I would always get by with my voice, but they would never let me get past the movement part of it. We weren't there yet for disability inclusion. Like, there was just no possibility. They were going to put a girl with a walking challenge in a musical in New York at that time.
Right.
It just wasn't going to happen.
Do you have a favorite musical? Just as a spectator, do you have a favorite show?
I love them all. I don't know. Well, I'm going to have to say I love... Okay, this is sentimental. Sorry, you're going to get a little sentimental out of me.
Good, good.
But I went to, when I was living in New York City, I went to see some musicals with my dad, and we went to see Phantom together. Mm. When he died, and my sister asked me to sing at his funeral. So I did that song, Wishing You Were Somehow Here Again. The hardest performance of my life. Boy, that's when you learn what you're capable of as a performer.
Yeah, it's tough to hold it together, I'm sure.
All of your emotions and perform, yeah.
When my dad passed away, I kind of fell into hosting for a couple years. That's kind of what led to this show eventually. But I was doing some live event hosting, and my dad passed away on a Thursday, and I had a weekend gig starting the next day. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That was a tough one for me. They gave me the out. They offered me the out. But I decided to take the stage because my dad was a performer. He was a musician.
Yeah.
That's what he did.
He told you to take your stage, yes.
He would have done the exact same thing. He would have told me to do that.
Yeah.
So I literally, less than 24 hours later, was on stage. So I think I really empathize with that moment for you singing Wishing You Were Somehow Here Again.
Yeah, it was not only tough notes in that one, but the meaning behind it all, the meaning in it. And I was like, oh, wow. Usually we want to add... so much meaning to everything we do. And here I was trying to take it away, take away the meaning.
Yeah.
And just hit the notes, because I was like, if I tap in right now, I'm just going to lose it.
So what eventually led to your move to Los Angeles?
Walking.
Interesting.
Yeah, I had a lot of trouble walking in New York City. I had a major rebuild in Atlanta, and I was in pain all the time in New York. I was still walking around in a walking cast, and I'd go out as far as I could go every day until my leg gave out. And then I would literally be sitting down on the sidewalk in New York City waiting until my foot decided to give me a break and go a little further. And so I just, I stuck it out for 2 years there. I did work a little. I did have some cruel encounters because of the way I walked, but I did all right there. It was the 2 years of trying to get around in that city with a bone, literally had bones hitting bones because they didn't know at the time that they had screwed up the surgery. And I literally had my leg bone hitting the bone in the ankle every step. So that's what I was walking on the entire time I was there. And for the next 28 years until two more rebuilds in 2016 and 2017, they took it apart again and finally cut off the end of the leg bone. And I'm still dealing with it though. It's it's still a thing, but I did have an AFL brace for a lot of years. I was in LA to ease the hit. Yeah, that's what got me to LA so I could drive.
When you showed up to LA, did you feel at home or did you feel like an outsider?
I am a kind of person who socially and I get along with people well. I can blend in any environment quickly. I connect to people easily. I hit the ground running and met a lot of people, had a lot of fun. Some of my friends came out from New York also. I immediately got engaged in classes and meeting people and going to things and events and all that stuff. So the community, I was very welcome in. But the industry was another story. That was a big setback. And I never thought that the battles would go on as long as they have.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, like, you know, I came out with my, you know, I was in my 20s and, you know, when you're looking your best in life, it's around that age, right? And had these great headshots and I sent them out and dropped them by places and I got in the doors for great auditions. I would wear a long skirt so that people didn't see my movements as easily because when they did, it was not a good thing. Doors would shut, you know, or they'd stop watching or they'd make a face and, if they noticed it and if they saw it, I wouldn't get back in that room again. I wouldn't get back in that door again. And so I was getting in and then somebody'd say something about the walk. A lot of times back then, they'd just say it right to your face or they'd sneer behind your back and you'd see it. And it just was like the doors were open until they saw me move and then they were closed. And that's how I started advocating. I met the wonderful Gail Williamson and Danny Murphy and friends who had disabilities, and I started advocating a lot with Danny Murphy because I was like, what's the problem? You know, it's like our head and shoulders mostly are on film and television, so I don't understand the problem. If you don't like the way I walk, sit me down, who cares? You know, right. Like, it doesn't matter. And there's lots of roles for people who limp, but they just don't give those roles to people who actually limp. They give them to stars enough. Because yeah, who don't know how to limp, incidentally,
right? Right.
Sorry, gonna say that to all of them. I used to joke that if they never let me work in this industry, I'm gonna start a profession where I charge them $500 an hour to teach them how to limp.
That's correctly. Hilarious.
I used to joke that I was gonna do that, but yeah, it was a real heartbreaker. I mean, I think in my 20s and 30s, I'd get into maybe 2 to 3 auditions a year, and we were fighting hard. I was going to casting workshops all the time, and you know, when I would get in, it was because of the people who got to know me at the casting workshops. And I made a few friends like Elaine Teitelbaum, who worked at Warner Brothers, who appreciated my work. And I got into the actor's studio and they really were champions of my work and they didn't care how I walked. They were just super appreciative of all the life experience I had at such a young age that I was not afraid to put it in the work because I'm never afraid to put it in the work. You should see the scary roles I play. I'm always using it. So the industry was very hard on me, but the community of people around me, like the people at the Actors Studio, have been like family, and you know, I have a lot of really good friends here. So I endured and started to slowly get more doors open, and we advocated louder and louder, and often than that would get the doors shut too, because at the time they just did not want to deal with people with disabilities in our industry. They just didn't. It's been a battle. It's been quite a battle. And then unfortunately in my 20s I lost both my parents, but in my very early 30s I got cancer because of all the treatments that I went through when
wow.
I was a kid. You know, all that exposure to radiation and the x-rays and all. So then I had to go deal with that, which was really scary because I'd lost both my parents too. Both my parents, who I thought were just such mighty strong people, and they both died so young that I was terrified. So, you know, then I spent the next, I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to keep up doing my acting. I thought it was going to be the end of my career because that was just starting to go, you know, and thankfully Barbara Bain and Alan Miller and the people at the Actors Studio helped me stay engaged, even though I was going back and forth to MD Anderson in Houston. I stayed engaged and Actors Studio was super supportive, and thankfully I had friends come in from all over to help me, MD Anderson, and get me through that stuff. And then I had a whole bunch more stuff to put into my work. And what came with that was an urgency that changed my career. And that urgency was health insurance. Because you cannot get insured if you have pre-existing conditions back then. And so I had to make health insurance through our union. So I lost my patience and my ability to smile and walk away when people were discriminating, because I was like, look, you are getting in the way of my life now. Get out of the way.
Wow.
You know, so I started going over people's heads. When I knew there was something I was right for, I would bother the heck out of my agent. I had this amazing agent, J.D. Sobel, for many years, and manager Lynn Bickelman, who would pick up the phone and fight for me. And J.D. fought and fought and fought and fought and fought for me through the years. And little by little, you know, literally, if people wouldn't let me, I would literally go right over their heads to the heads of the shows, because I was like, I need to make my health insurance to stay alive. We need to stop discriminating. And that's when I became so fierce. And it also changed my work, because, you know, I was no longer that sweet little nice girl who was trying to please everybody. I was like, get out of my way. I got work to do.
I like that part of you.
Yeah, that's when I became fierce. And then, you know, the older we get, the less patience we have for meanness. Anyone can do the research and find out the number one target of a bully is a person with a disability. That's your number one target. And I had already dealt with bullying ever since I became disabled as a child and growing up. And then to deal with it in the entertainment industry again, I felt like I'd gone back to the fifth grade. It's infuriating. There are a lot of adult bullies in the world. And if there's one in the room, they're going to come pick on me because they think they can crush me. Then they learn they can't because they can't. If a bully was going to be able to crush me, it would have happened decades.
Right.
So what surprises people is that, you know, they always look down typically on people, bullies I'm talking about, look down on people with challenges and medical challenges and disabilities and differences, and they think they can overcome you, conquer you, crush you, break your spirit. And the strongest people on the planet are the people who've overcome the most, not the people who've overcome the least.
Absolutely.
They think they can crush you. And a lot of us, you know, we're smiling because we want to, not because we're weak. We're smiling because we're still here. We're smiling because we've accomplished a few things and we've worked harder than everybody else. It's always amazed me that bullies think that that spirit is crushable, because the disabled people I know are the most incredibly spirited, strong, smiling, happy, laughing, goofing off people I've ever known.
100%.
At least the ones I hang around. Yes, they're unbreakable. And, you know, it's not that we don't feel. I feel immensely, you know, and I feel pain when people are trying to make my life harder, because it's been hard enough and I'm just trying to accomplish some good things. And when it gets too hard, you know who I call? People who've been through worse. And that's my friends in the disabled community.
I just want to clarify for our listeners that hitting that SAG health insurance minimum is not a walk in the park either. It's not just something you fall into year after year. You have to work to hit those minimums.
Yeah, and hard. And, you know, they underpay. The majority of the industry is paid what we call scale, which is minimum wage. And even 30 years in, they still want to pay you minimum wage, or they want to cut you to way below minimum wage if they can get away with it with the budget on something. And it's a constant battle to make that health insurance. Yeah, that actually made me more fierce, made me less patient, which I learned has been a good thing. And so I think you might have heard me say this at the event that we had. I'm not patient anymore. I'm not nice anymore when someone's getting in my way.
Good. I love that, Eileen. I think we need to be less patient in our community. Let's be less patient. Let's be less nice.
Absolutely. And I do tell all the kids that who come my way that, as for mentoring, I tell them that the biggest mistake I ever made was smiling and walking away 1,000 times.
Mm.
Smiling and letting the bully get away with it, letting the mean person get away with it. I don't do that anymore. As a matter of fact, I mean, I've written letters to the heads of shows saying, what are we going to do about discrimination in your casting office?
Wow. I'm literally ballsy. Very ballsy.
I don't even care who I piss off anymore, because what are they going to do? Keep me out of work?
Right. Exactly.
And they're going to penalize me for fighting for my life, for my right to exist, for my right to make a living and to keep a roof over my head, and for my right to make health insurance, because I remind them, if they're bad enough, how would you feel if it were you?
Yeah.
Or your child? Do you want people to treat you the way you're treating me? Do you want people to treat your child the way you're treating me? Because your child could end up in an accident or with a medical challenge or a vaccine that paralyzes them certainly did happen to a whole lot of kids over the last 4 years. And now they're going to deal with it for the rest of their lives like I just did. Are you going to be as cruel to them, your own child? Do you want the world to be cruel to that child? And that's why I speak about it like I did at that event where I said, we keep telling these kids to endure all these things, and then we're sending them out into a cruel world. So we have to change the world we're sending them into. Hmm. We're human beings like everybody else. The day that I became paralyzed, I did not change who I was as a human being in terms of my hopes, my dreams for my life, my wanting to do some good in the world. I now had greater challenges, but why would anybody want to make that harder? So I challenge people constantly, and I know people don't always like to be challenged, but I'm like, I have to challenge their humanity if they're trying to keep somebody who's fought as hard as I have, if they're trying to keep them out of work over something like a walking challenge or because they fought for their rights.
I love your organic passion, Eileen. I just love it about you, truly. Let me rewind because I thought I heard you say this and it blew my mind. So your cancer diagnosis was directly correlated or related to repeated x-rays due to that?
Yeah, radiation causes thyroid cancer. You know, I did this show called Miracle Workers years ago that I was casting all these people with real medical challenges and for this ABC DreamWorks show. And, you know, I took the show to Houston because I knew the best doctors in the world were there. And we interviewed some of the doctors at Texas Children's Hospital. And they said most of the kids, a lot of kids that end up with cancer in their early 30s, late 20s, it's because they were exposed to things in their childhood. A lot of kids that spend a lot of time in hospitals end up with thyroid cancer in their early 30s. Radiation exposure is usually what causes thyroid cancer. Now, my dad did die of thyroid cancer, but we had his cells on wax, and I was able to get them to my doctors at MD Anderson, and they said, your cancer is not genetic from what your dad had. So mine was from exposure to radiation. Yeah, so I lost my thyroid.
Goodness gracious, when it rains, it pours.
Yeah, it really does. And I share my story because I want people to realize that, you know, when somebody with a disability comes in a room and they're trying and they get a big old smile on their face, honor it. They're not smiling because everything's been easy. They're not trying because they've never had to work for anything, because that's some weird myth that's out there in the world. They think, oh, if you have a disability, everything's easy and everything's paid for and blah, blah, blah. That is nonsense. It financially wiped out my parents when I was a child. It's been the burden of my entire life trying to pay for my medical expenses. Still to this day, every year it's a concern. Those vaccine funds are nonsense because they don't actually pay out. They make the burden of proof on you. And if you're from a poor family and your parents are just trying to keep you alive, they can't go hire a lawyer,
right,
to go fight that system for you. And people need to hear our stories more so that they understand the reality. And I know I've said this in a few of the articles when they've interviewed me, like the Forbes women and stuff. I was like, I think that if people ever saw the journey, they wouldn't sneer when I come in a room or try to keep me out. They would probably cheer.
So how do we show them that journey?
One, they've got to let us work in a bigger capacity, which is what we were talking about at that TV Academy event. You know, we had a strange situation happen there where we have these organizations that have come in that are speaking for us. I'm sorry, but you don't have the right to speak for me. I need to speak for me, and I need to tell my story. And every person in our community needs to have their own voice. We don't need these organizations as the collective voice that's speaking to the entertainment industry for us. That's not helping us. That's holding us back.
Interesting point.
If they keep being the barrier between us and the entertainment industry, and I get it, they make a lot of money off of informing the industry on how to hire us and blah, blah, blah. Well, the industry could save a lot of money by just hiring us, right, instead of doing all of this nonsense. You know, just get all the middle people out of the way and just start hiring us and let our stories be heard and let us get in a place where people can see our work. I remember fighting for years to get on CSI, fighting for years and years and years trying to get on that show. And I just never could. I mean, if I ever got an audition, it was always because I had to pull strings, and then I'd get 4 hours notice, and I'd come in and find out everybody else had a week with the material, and just was like, oh, and I was pulling strings to get in the door, and it was heartbreaking. I was trying so hard to get on one of those shows. And years later, there was a show casting a pilot and I really, really wanted to get on it. So I made a tape here and I sent it to the casting directors who knew me when I was young in Atlanta, and they covered the whole East Coast. I sent the tape in there and I got a call back for the show. So then my agent asked, can she just do the call back in LA since the producers are all there? And they're like, nope, she's got to fly herself back. I was like, fine, for a shot at a show, I'm going back to Atlanta.
Sure.
And got myself back there. And before I got on the plane back to LA again, I got the call that I'd booked the role on in the pilot.
Wow. Right?
And then I went to work and met amazing people, David Hudgens and Niels Arden Obleff was the director of the pilot. And they just were so open. They were so open to like who I am and the energy, the fire that I had to play this fiery character that spans from her 30s all the way to almost 60. So much fun playing that role. And so they kept expanding the character. If it had gone to another season, I was going to be even a bigger character because David Hutchins had already told me that. And I was so excited, but the show got canceled. Point of this is to say that I get to the wrap party for the show. And I meet this huge showrunner, Carol Mendelsohn, and I don't go meet her. She comes to me and she introduces herself and told me how much she appreciated my work and how much she loved that audition tape. And she said these words, "Why have we never seen you before?"
That's a great question. Why?
And I just shook my head and I was like, I've been trying for over a decade to get on your shows and I had to fly myself to Atlanta.
Right. And,
you know, just because that's what I'm up against in LA, you know, and Atlanta was always much more open. They were much more accommodating. New York, I had a few bad incidences, but they were also much more accommodating. But LA, the words I have for this town are still so bold and fierce because they still are not accepting of people with real challenges. And they would rather go find a child who's never worked before, who knows nothing about the business, and throw them a massive role than to give a shot to any of the adults who have been in this business fighting for an opportunity for decades. And that breaks my heart. And that's what we were speaking about at the TV Academy. Instead of patronizing this community with token hires of kids that weren't even in the business, hire those of us who are. Hire those of us who've been in training and working hard. We've been working so hard. We should be able to, by the age I'm at now, I shouldn't have to be worrying about health insurance or how I'm going to keep a roof over my head in 10 years, you know? Everything I've ever worked for has gone into my medical care, and I wish people understood that.
Eileen, you're also an accomplished motivational speaker. When you speak to kids or just groups of individuals, what do you set out to accomplish?
I always ask first, who's my audience? I have to know who they are so I can connect to them. When I first started speaking, it was just because I'm not trained to do it or anything, but people just said, will you come and speak? And I was like, sure, why not? Will you come and tell your story? Sure, why not? Over the years and throughout my life, I found out that when I tell my story, it helps people. So therefore, I'll tell my story. And it helps people who are disabled find the courage to go after their dreams. It helps people who are not disabled understand a little better what we go through as we're fighting hard to live our lives. That's how I started speaking. One time, a friend of mine, Pam, who I'd met at a thing called Global Genes, which used to be called, I forget what it was called, but it was something about undiagnosed illnesses with kids, but now it's called Global Genes. And they asked me to speak, so I spoke at that. And then Pam asked me to speak to challenged patients in a community of people who literally are every day on the brink of death. They have a condition where their blood vessels could burst in their brain at any time and just kill them. And so they live a frightening life, right? Always never knowing. And so that time, I sat in the back and I listened for a while. And there was a whole panel of doctors talking. And I listened to the patients and I listened to their questions. And then I walked up to give my speech and I literally crumpled up my speech because it didn't matter anymore. I just curled it up in my hands and I looked out at them and I was like, so, they tell you you could die at any moment. And I just started and I was like, I remember when they said to my parents that this girl is never going to live. I remember that. I learned about it years later, but I remember it. from my mom saying they said you were never going to live, and then they said you'd never walk again. So what I learned as a child is that they're not always right. And I turned and I looked at all the panel of doctors, and they all started laughing. I was like, no offense, but they're not always right, and I don't always choose to believe them.
What a moment.
Yeah, it was, and they all laughed. They thought it was funny because it was very humorous. But then I went on to tell them the way I see things, having lost parents young and having faced my life more than a few times. And I just shared with them, I was like, look, it's a tough set of cards and it is scary. And if you know you only got one day left, live it up, man. I just connected with each one of them that I could in the audience. And I just said more about what I'd been through and why I was standing here saying what I was saying, and gave them as much empathy as I could, but also like take the fear away, because if we've got to go tomorrow, I like joke with them. I said, I can't wait until, you know, I'm going to have as much fun as I can. I'm going to go for trying to make everything happen that I want to make happen in this world before I leave, until it's time for me to fly. And then I might have to come back and haunt some people.
I just want to repeat what you said, because it's so profound in its simplicity. When I tell my story, it helps people. That is profound. And I think that's exactly what our audience needs to hear.
Yeah. Because I think so many people feel alone in their battles. And I know in the disabled community, people feel alone. And they feel like they've got it worse than everybody. And I know I've felt that way too. There have been times where I'm up against so much of it that I'm just like, stop, everyone stop putting more on me. I'm just trying to survive. Some of the greatest gifts I got in life were people who, MD Anderson did this for me when I came there, because they knew I was alone. The doctors were amazing. They took me in like one of their own kids. I had Dr. Randy Weber and Stephen Sherman, and they treated me like one of their children. And I also got patient advocates there who were cancer survivors. And to me, the greatest gift in life is to have somebody to talk to who's been through more than you. Because then you can sit there and say, okay, how did you do this? And how do I do this? I just learned to be drawn to people who've been through more. When I'm having my worst times, as I said before, I reach out to my friends who've been through more. And I ask them what to do, or I tell them what I'm going through. And every single time they'll have me laughing by the end of, and lots of them call me when they're going through a hard time. You know, one of my closest friends in the world right now has a brain cancer recurrence, and we are constantly sending each other stupid memes and jokes and music and recipes for healthy food. And, you know, I think the greatest thing we can do is share our stories with the next round of people going through it, you know, and we're here, in my opinion, on this earth to help each other through this life. I don't see any other way to look at it, because I've watched amazing people die very young, and I've watched children die. And I can't make any sense of the feeling that we're on this earth to acquire stuff so that we can make other people think we're better than them. I don't get that. I can't wrap my head around it. I'd love to have a big house, but for me, that would be so I could invite everyone over, you know, so we could have parties and holidays for all the people who don't have family and a place to go for someone when they're in trouble. Other than that, I don't understand the rest of the nonsense. I just don't. We're here to help each other, and we're all supposed to be helping each other through this journey of life. Everybody's got something that somebody else doesn't have, right? So say you're born into a lot of money, and then you've got a friend you go to school with whose parents died young and they've got nothing. Well, would it hurt you to help them? No. If you did, you might lift them up and give them a shot that they might not have otherwise had. If you're born with a ton of money, or you're married into a ton of money and you have excess, you could pay off a kid's hospital bill, not only take a burden off of their entire family and their parents, but maybe save that kid's life. And if you are one of those kids who's got nothing because you grew up in the world with nothing and you've had to survive, you have survival skills that those other kids don't have because their life was a lot easier. So to me, it's a big puzzle piece, this life, and we fit each other's pieces. I'm the first person to walk away from people who harm other people. I don't have a lot of patience for it. I call people out on it. They don't like it. I don't care. Because if you're going through this life harming people, you might be stopping our world changers. And everybody's life is hard enough without anybody else's help to make it harder. I've never understood the need to bully. I've never understood the need to be greedy and keep other people out. It's like, if we all work together, it's like a big basketball team or baseball team, or it's better with a team, right? That's the way I see it. And I think the entertainment industry could use some lessons in that, because I think they've left out a lot of their greatest stories. I think they've left out a lot of their game changers, original stories and original characters, because they have this illusion of perfection that they like to put out into the world that somehow makes them feel above other people. And I'm just not one of the people who buys into that. I don't think anybody's above anybody else. I think we're all in the same battle, just with different decks of cards to play with, because nobody gets out alive, right?
Right.
You're not going to live forever, that's for sure. And I can tell you that a lot of the people that I know in this lifetime, when they're really in trouble, my phone rings. And incidentally, in the last like year or two, I've got like 10 dear friends going through horrific things. We're all in touch all the time right now. I'll fly out and help when I can and go visit when I can. I remember being the young one going through stuff when nobody had any concept of it. You know, at a younger age, people don't really get it. And as I'm getting older, when people are really in trouble, they call those of us who know how to survive. That's who they call. And I figured, you know, our entertainment industry would do itself a favor by putting out some of these kinds of survival stories, because then people wouldn't be so afraid. I heard Tony Robbins say that people's greatest fear is the fear of paralysis. That's like the number one fear or something like that. And I laughed when I heard him say it. I literally laughed out loud. I had one of his books, and my thought, and then I blurted out loud, is that's because they don't know enough of us. I'm not saying it's not hard, and I'm not saying anybody wants to go through it, because I'd like to take it back and see what life looked like without it. But if they knew enough of us, they wouldn't be so terrified of medical challenges. And they also might see the light at the end of the tunnel and all the strength that comes with it.
You mentioned bullying a couple times. What would you say to a listener of this show who has a severe disability and is experiencing bullying? What would your advice be to that individual?
Are you talking to about a child?
Yeah, let's talk to a child here.
A child, okay. The number one thing is, get out of harm's way first. That's the first thing, because I know they're brutal. I went through some brutal things when I was a kid. And then go get help. I remember writing an article once called Find Somebody Bigger. It was about making sure you have somebody who will defend you. When I was a child, I had brothers and a father who would defend me. And then as an adult, my find somebody bigger meant go over their heads, because you're going to experience the bullying as an adult even more. That's when you have to go over their heads, because the people in charge are the risk takers. They often don't know what's happening underneath them in their companies or in their jobs or whatever. But as a child, my dad taught me to stand up to them, but make sure I'm safe first. So like if there's six kids chasing me home from school and throwing rocks and knocking me down, I'm still going to stand up, because that's who I am. Still going to get in their face. But I think you have to make sure you're safe, because kids have gotten even more dangerous from what I understand. But I do believe in standing up to them. And there was an incident that my father pulled when I was a child that I've never forgotten. And a bully that just terribly hurt me when I was a kid and I was alone. And he caught me and he tried to wrap my bad leg around the metal bar that you hold on to to walk into the swimming pool. And I, you know, and I fought like hell and I got away from him and I went in and my dad was like, what's wrong? And I told him and he just saw his jaw clench. You know, my father was a very strong man. He was former military. He grew up in the middle of the race wars of Chicago. These were some tough dudes coming out of Chicago back then. He surprised me because he didn't jump out and go find that kid. What he did do was tell me to go get all my brothers because we were having a family meeting. I've never forgotten this. He brings in all of them and he says, so we're having a party at the pool on Saturday. I was like, that's how we're handling this? We're having a party? And he told all the brothers, because every one of them was under 18. They were 17 and under, to go tell all the kids in the neighborhood that we were having a pool party Saturday. And we did. And when all those kids were out there and that little bully and his little entourage, my dad walked out with my brothers and they encircled that kid. And my oldest brother, who was like the big football star of the high school at the time, Jerry, was 17, picked up that kid. And my father spoke, and he spoke for all these kids. He picked the kid up off the ground. No one would approve of these tactics these days, right? He picked that kid up in the air, and my father spoke. And he said, if you even look at my daughter ever again or dare to touch her, I'm sending these boys, he points to the little ones, out to find you. And then I'm sending these ones, the bigger brothers, to find your brother at the high school. And they're going to do to him what you did to her in front of everyone. And then I am going to go find your father, and I'm going to beat him into the ground. Do you understand me? And that kid was shaking, and he was a mean little kid. He was mean to everybody, and he was like 12 or whatever, a few years older than me. And they didn't hurt the kid. Jerry set him down, and he took off running. And I never saw that kid around the center area of our little neighborhood again. But I learned something that day. I mean, those were definitely old school tactics of humiliate the bully in front of their friends, because it's their friends that egg them on, and they're trying to be cool in front of their friends, which is why they do it in front of people. They attack and they bully. Now, keep in mind, these kids were always cruel and always hurting me. When you don't allow them to be cool in front of their friends, they stop. And I've also noticed that when the cool kids in school, and I did do an interview about this earlier in life, when the cool kids come and sit by you, if you're a kid in school going through it, I remember in the fifth grade that I was getting teased and bothered by everybody. And the coolest kid in school that everyone had a crush on was Steve Conrad, the writer that wrote Wrestling Ernest Hemingway and a lot of big movies. We were in fifth grade together, and he was a kid everybody was in love with. And he pulled up and sat next to me in school one day. And then the girls were all like, why is he sitting with her? And then his friends came and sat, and they were all the little football, you know, little league football kids and everything. That ended the torment in that school. Wow. At that age. Yeah. So my interview that time, they entitled it, Be the Cool Kid. I believe, and I could be really wrong about this, and I know that society has changed a lot, but I believe you stand up to those bullies right in front of all their friends in a safe environment to do that. If you can't in that environment, you do it on another day when you have backup, and you stand up to them because you have to. I've had to do it all my life, stand up to whoever the bully is. And I'm still doing it. I'm still having to do it in our business. And if we don't stand up to them, they just keep getting away with it. They're more afraid of you if they believe you're going to call them out on it. And I'd rather they be afraid of me than make fun of me or keep me out of work or keep me out of health insurance. Let them be afraid. I'm fine with that. What I've also found is that when you stand up for yourself boldly, if you boldly stand up for yourself at any age, guess what happens? Bullies back down and strong people are drawn to you. What my mom told me when I was little was, what you have there is a great judge of character. Other people's character. She said, they are not showing you what's wrong with you. They are showing you what's wrong with them.
Yeah.
And so through life, I started to learn to say when someone's being a jerk, thank you for showing me who you are. Yep. Next. And I am moving on because I don't have any time for it anymore. And when I'm bold and I speak my mind, yes, it scares weak people. Yes, it scares people who are doing wrong to other people. And that upsets them. But it draws in the strongest people. And I am so grateful to have the strongest friends across decades of my life. From childhood, high school, everywhere I've traveled, I've collected friends who literally show up for me. You know, when I got cancer in my early 30s, 17 friends came in from all over into Houston, traveled in from all over to be there. I have the strongest friends, and that's fine. I don't need weak friends. I don't mind weak friends if they're not hurting me, but I don't need them. I need strong friends. And so if my being bold brings me the strongest people, I'm all for that. I love having strong people in my life. I'm so in awe of strong people. We encourage each other. Life is just a lot more fun when you stand up to it.
Bold and fierce sums you up to a T, Eileen. I am so in awe of your raw passion. It is endlessly encouraging and energizing. Thank you for your passion, Eileen.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you for telling these stories.
Folks, you can check out Eileen's IMDb at Eileen Gruba, EileenGrubba. Her Instagram and X/Twitter is also all one word, Eileen Gruba, and her website is EileenGrubba.com. Eileen, you are just a passionate person, and that turns me on. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, thank you, Danny. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me. And I just want to say, I hope we hear your voice a lot more because your voice is just stunning. It's so wonderful.
Well, thank you. I look forward to narrating a project that you are the star of. How about that?
Oh, I would love that. Good night.
Bye-bye.